meeting Tuesday. Goodell said Vic would have to demonstrate what he learned and whether he'd be a positive influence moving forward. And Vic is also trying to work out a deal with the Humane Society of the U.S. He told the group's president he wants to be involved in a program aimed at eradicating dog fighting among urban teens. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
California voters have rejected nearly all of a package of fiscal measures intended to help the state out of its shaky financial position. The measures were backed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, California faces a deficit of more than $21 billion, and there's no clear way to pay for this. The governor's likely to consider severe cutbacks in state government services. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. The Schwartz Family Band consists of Papa Scott on guitar, sisters Samantha and Kitty on flute and cello, and brother Aaron on violin. The band will appear on the Noontime Music Series at the Mills Breast Cancer Institute in Urbana on Thursday, and they'll play live at noon on the Wednesday edition of Live and Local, your connection to local music, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. The only fatal nuclear reactor incident in American history took place in January of 1961 in rural Idaho. It was an experimental reactor that was operated by the Army. Three men died in this event. Some people believe that it might have been sabotage. It might have been some sort of strange murder-suicide. But the real causes, says our guest for this morning, Todd Tucker, the real causes were shoddy maintenance and safety flaws. This morning we'll be talking about this story. It's the story that he tells in his book, Atomic America, How a Deadly Explosion and a Feared Admiral Changed the Course of Nuclear History. And not only does it tell the story of this particular event, but it sets that within the context of a much larger story, and that is the rivalry between the Navy, the Army, and the Air Force all around the development and use of nuclear power. The book is published by the Free Press. It's out now if you want to take a look at it. Our guest is a graduate of Notre Dame University, got a history degree there. He also served as an officer with the U.S. Navy's Nuclear Submarine Force. He's the author of a book, Notre Dame versus the Klan, that was published in 2004. In fact, we talked about it here on this program. He's also written for several national magazines. He lives in Valparaiso, Indiana, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. Mr. Tucker, hello.
Hello, how are you
today? I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
Good.
Well, I appreciate you talking with us once again.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I think probably if you start people thinking about nuclear accidents, of course, they will think about Chernobyl. And here in the United States, they'll think about Three Mile Island. I'm sure to a lot of people, myself included, this is a new story. This is a new one. And they don't think about rural Idaho as being a setting for a nuclear accident. Was this something that at the time that it happened, did this get coverage in the news?
It did. It definitely, there was no cover-up. It was the Army, to their credit, was very open about their nuclear power program, in contrast to the Navy's especially. But I do think that, it didn't receive as much coverage as you would expect, and I think that that's just because in 1961, the whole concept of nuclear power was so new that, the public didn't even know that that was a big story, that a reactor had blown up and killed three people.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the thing that you try to get across is, or at least one of the things, is that maybe people said some things about what had happened and why, who was responsible, what the responsibility was, and that maybe some things that were said or rumors flew around about what actually happened. And it sounds as if yes, it's human error, but it's an error that can be perhaps explained in terms of procedures and in terms of design, and not so much that someone intentionally did something with the idea that they were going to precipitate this devastating event.
That's right. I mean, I think people, especially people in the industry and in the nuclear power community, which was an exceedingly small community in 1961, it's not all that surprising that they didn't want to believe that a reactor could be so poorly designed. So there, a lot of folklore grew up almost immediately about, you know, sabotage and a love triangle and a murder-suicide, all of which there's, you know, not a shred of evidence for, and there's kind of overwhelming evidence that the SL1 reactor was designed poorly and maintained poorly, and that the crew was ill-supervised.
Mm. Well, just to get away from just this particular event just for a second, and to talk about the, as I said, the context in which this occurs, this does happen at a time when, well, I suppose there's been service rivalry forever there, but there was particularly service rivalry around this issue of exploitation of nuclear power. And at the time that this happened, the Navy had already designed, constructed, and demonstrated a nuclear powered submarine. They were definitely in the lead. But also there had been an effort by the Air Force to develop a nuclear-powered plane, and then this much smaller effort in the Army to develop small reactors. Their idea was, you know, we have these very remote outposts. We're up in the Arctic keeping our eye out for an attack by the Soviet Union, and they were just interested in building small reactors that would provide a relatively small amount of power to a small station. Theirs was perhaps the Army program was the, in terms of its objective, was the most modest of all three.
It was the Army, you're right, the Army's mission for nuclear power was probably the most prosaic, but they had some real notable successes, especially compared to the Air Force, which threw about $1 billion over the course of 15 years at this very chaotic quest to build a nuclear jet, which never even came close to fruition.
Yeah, that maybe we could talk about that a little bit, and that may again be sort of surprise to people, the very idea. But this was the time of the Cold War, and apparently in the Air Force they had this idea that, well, if you had a nuclear powered plane, in a very real sense, you could fly forever almost. You'd never have to land and refuel.
Well, and that's what was interesting to me was that the Navy and the Air Force, they both started about the same time, the Navy on the nuclear submarine and the Air Force on the nuclear plane. And really, at the very beginning, there wasn't, you know, one of those wasn't any more fanciful than the other. They were both kind of outlandish ideas, especially starting as they did, you know, when nuclear power had not been harnessed by anybody other than in the form of a weapon. So they were both kind of outlandish, and as it happened, the Navy just, you know, progressed steadily under the leadership of Admiral Rickover and really, really did some remarkable things in a remarkably short period of time, whereas the Air Force just continually threw money at this and, like I said, never really came close.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose it does seem like a crazy, and maybe it's because of the way things developed, we don't think that the idea of a nuclear-powered submarine is so crazy, but the idea of a nuclear-powered aircraft somehow seems on the face of it to be kind of crazy. But maybe, as you say, it has to do with the fact that one worked and the other didn't.
Well, there are just some fundamental kind of worst-case scenarios with a nuclear airplane that really beg inspects. I mean, what do you do if a nuclear airplane crashes?
Mm-hmm.
A nuclear reactor on a submarine is kind of a closed system, whereas a jet engine is a very, very open system. And so there were the shielding problems for the crew, but, you know, like I said, they were both kind of equally theoretical at the outset.
Yeah.
And, I think it was in those early days, the Navy was probably, you know, it was just as possible for the Navy to fail as the Air Force. But the Navy benefited from some really kind of magical leadership.
Yeah. And that's, I guess, also that the idea, in a sense, was the same, that is, behind both of these things, was some almost limitless source of power.
That's correct.
And I guess at the time we were still using submarines that could cruise underwater for limited time, but they depended on batteries for that. And actually most, you know, we think of submarines as things that go under the water. Well, in fact, submarines probably spend most of their time on the surface.
Well, they did then. Not
yeah.
Then.
I mean, they did. Yeah. Yes, they did. They did then. Yeah. They spent most of their time on the surface. They ran off of diesel engines and they could go underwater for limited periods of time. The idea of the nuclear powered submarine was that you could be underwater for virtually unlimited amount of time.
Right. The kind of the singular language they used to describe that in the Navy was the true submarine, because mm-hmm. you're right. Mm-hmm. The submarine was really, it was a kind of a small surface ship that could submerge for short periods of time. And it was not a, it was not, although the submarine had turned out to be very strategic in World War II, it was not by and large viewed that way. But a submarine that could stay underwater for months at a time, you know, really promised to kind of change the nature of warfare. And that was the vision they had. A nuclear bomber would do the same thing. A bomber that could stay aloft for weeks at a time would do this, you know, would be just as fundamental a shift.
Yeah. And this was at a time also when, obviously, we were in the Cold War here, and that there was a lot of debate and discussion in the government and the Pentagon about how wars would be fought in the future, and that people, a lot of people were really making the argument that air power was it. That was the beginning, that was the end, full stop. And that people were, in fact, arguing that given that, that they would say, well, really, what do we need a Navy for? Or at least, what do we need a big Navy? And
right.
the Navy, they weren't really happy about that. And the guy who really came forward, not only to push the idea of the nuclear-powered submarine, but who brought the Navy back from near death in this Cold War period, he's the feared admiral that you talk about in the subtitle. This is Hyman Rickover.
You're right. The Navy after World War II was really fighting for survival, because this belief that strategic bombing and atomic bombs in particular had kind of made everything else obsolete was really becoming a mainstream belief. So the Navy was really fighting for its life. And when Rickover came along, you know, he kind of quickly reasserted the Navy's supremacy in his strategic planning. And like I point out in the book, the admirals rewarded Rickover for saving the Navy by trying to fire him almost continuously throughout his career.
Yeah. Our guest, let me just very quickly reintroduce our guest, is Todd Tucker. We're talking about his book, Atomic America. The subtitle is How a Deadly Explosion and a Feared Admiral Changed the Course of Nuclear History. So it is, in part, as we have discussed here, about the way that the U.S. military tried to use nuclear power and how the Navy succeeded where essentially everybody else failed. And also, though, about this one incident, this nuclear reactor explosion that was an experimental reactor that was operated by the U.S. Army that was in rural Idaho. And this happened in early in January in 1961. Three people who were working on the reactor were killed. And that really meant was the end of the Army's program to develop nuclear power in this way. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I guess that's really, that again, this happened at a time when the Navy had already launched and demonstrated a nuclear submarine. The Nautilus had already done its thing. So they were definitely way out ahead. And I think at the time of this accident, it was around that time that the Air Force finally gave up. We talked about how the Navy and the Air Force started about the same time with the idea of the nuclear sub and the nuclear plane. Well, also at about this time of the accident, the Air Force finally just gave up on the idea of the nuclear plane.
Well, I wouldn't say they gave up. What happened was President Kennedy, the very recently inaugurated JFK, was the guy that finally came along with enough political will to see the nuclear airplane project for what it was, which was just a massive waste of money and time. So Kennedy canceled it, but even up to the last minute, the Air Force was protesting that the Soviet Union was flying nuclear bombers all around Moscow and that this was a huge strategic error. So the Air Force didn't give it up willingly.
Yeah.
And to this day, I mean, if you talk to people that work on that program, they'll insist that they were, you know, that they were getting closer all the time. But the two events did almost coincide. The explosion at SL-1 took place in January 61, and the nuclear aircraft project was canceled in March 1961. So they almost did coincide.
And is it? And do I have it right that after the explosion of the reactor, the SL-1, that then at that point the Army pretty much abandoned this program?
The Army program, even though you're right in that the book revolves around this accident in an Army reactor, the Army had some notable successes in their program, including actually powering an Army base beneath the ice cap in Greenland for over a year with a nuclear reactor. So the Army program kind of lingered on for a while, but it was definitely, it signaled the end of the Army program for sure.
Hmm. I think we're getting a caller lined up here. And other folks, if you have questions, you can certainly call in and be involved in the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. And so I think we have somebody on our toll-free line, St. Francisville, I believe, here, line number four. Hello.
Yes, I'm on a cell phone, so I'll try to make it quick.
Okay.
I'd also heard the rumor about like a love triangle thing, but in your research, I'd also heard that one of the guys that was, the rod ejected him pinning to the top of the building or whatever, and he stayed there for several days or weeks or something like that. Can you expand on that any?
Yeah.
Take it off the air.
You've got one of those rumors is true and one isn't. They're like I said, the love triangle rumor grew up almost immediately that there was a murder-suicide, and the government investigated it, and like I said, there's not a scrap of evidence that that occurred. About the crew member being pinned above the ceiling of the reactor, that is true. Richard Legg was standing on the reactor vessel head when it exploded, and a shield plug, which is a long metal rod, was ejected at about 85 feet per second, went through his groin, came out through his shoulder with enough force that it lifted him 14 feet and pinned him above this kind of steaming destroyed reactor, and it was so radioactive, and his position was so strange that it took the government about 6 days to figure out how to get him down and what to do with his body, which was just lethally radioactive.
Mm-hmm. And that was, and we can tell the story maybe in a little bit more detail, but I think the challenge that they had in dealing with this afterwards was that the building inside the building was so highly radioactive that the people who were trying to deal with what had happened and to clean it up and to recover the remains of these three guys, it was so hot that people could only spend 30 seconds or something like that in the building. So that right away they saw the two men that were dead who were lying there. But I think it actually even took a little while before them to realize what had happened to the third man. And then, as you say, they had to figure out, because the body was so radioactive, they had to figure out, okay, how are we going to manage to get him down and to handle the remains, given that the levels of radioactivity in the building and the bodies of the three men were so hot. They had to be very careful in the way that they handled them.
That's right. There were a couple of problems there. One was that, like you said, the radioactivity was so high in the building that nobody could stay in there longer than 60 seconds at a time. The other problem was that his position, where he was directly above this reactor, it made it very difficult to get him down. And there was also a fear that there might be so much fissionable material on his body that if he was to fall in the reactor, it might make it critical again. Mm-hmm. So they had to be enormously careful. And once they determined that the body, where it was, pinned to the ceiling, was stable, they were very methodical on about how they finally got him down.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Atlanta, Illinois. This is line one. Hello.
Hopefully that you didn't cover this subject while I was dialing in. But anyway, environmentally, there's a tragedy in the people involved. Environmentally today, is the site still radioactive? Was there environmental damage at the time around there, or was it pretty well contained? Were they smart enough to have a pretty good containment building?
That's a very astute question. The SL1 reactor was not built with a containment building, and the justification for it was that, one, it was extremely low power. It was about a 300-kilowatt reactor, and because of its proposed remote locations where it was going to be in the Arctic. So it had kind of a metal silo around it, but it was by no means a containment structure. In other words, it was not designed to contain an explosion from within. So when the reactor blew up, all this contamination was pretty much streaming out of the building. The building actually remained intact surprisingly well, considering it wasn't designed to be a containment. But nonetheless, a huge amount of radioactivity spewed out of the reactor and went over the southeastern Idaho landscape, and it was tracked carefully by the scientists, but there was really very little they could do about it. The site remained highly radioactive and still does, and there's been periodic cleanup efforts over the years, but you know, that kind of stuff does not go away easily.
Very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Todd Tucker, and we're talking about his book, Atomic America, that does indeed tell the story of this nuclear reactor explosion that happened in rural Idaho, January 1961. It was a research reactor being operated by the Army there. And again, questions are welcome. Maybe that I would have you talk a little bit about the reactor and how it was designed, because it certainly seems that there were some serious design problems here that made this accident a lot more likely. And it seems that a lot of it centers around the fact that, and maybe people understand, nuclear reactors have these control rods, and that the control rods have to do with how the reaction proceeds. And if you pull the rods out, the reaction goes faster, and you put the rods in and it slows it down. And this particular reactor, it only had one control rod.
Well, it's not exactly right. It had five control rods, but the issue was that it was designed such that one rod, the central control rod, could make the reactor critical all by itself. Kind of a fundamental safety flaw when I get asked the question, you know, what were the results of this accident? That's one of them. It's called the one stuck rod criteria, where reactors are designed such that the withdrawal of any single rod, even the most reactive, can't make a reactor critical all by itself. So that it was designed that way, which was a flaw. But then not only that, there were maintenance procedures that actually had people stand on top of the reactor and manually withdraw this rod with their hands. So if they had their hands on this central control rod and withdrew it too far, it would make the reactor critical, which is just kind of an incredible thing to think about.
And that's, there's maybe some question about exactly the circumstances, but essentially that's what happened. The one man who ended up being pinned to the ceiling was standing on top. Mm-hmm. He was pulling the rod out, and, you know, who knows? What happened is that it got pulled out too far too fast. Why that happened, does anybody really know?
Well, here are kind of the things that are not in dispute. The crew was performing maintenance on the control rod drives, which required them to manually withdraw the rod a small amount. That central rod, like you said, was withdrawn too far and too fast, resulted in a massive supercriticality and an explosion. So that's kind of beyond dispute. Who was actually doing the lifting of that rod, and what their motivation, if any, was, that's kind of the crux of the controversy. The guy that was pinned to the ceiling was actually, by most accounts, not the one that was lifting the rod. He was the supervisor, and he was standing on, that was Richard Legg,
mm-hmm.
He was standing on the vessel head while Jack Burns, who was kind of, by all accounts, the most troubled member of the crew, was the one that was actually lifting the rod. And Burns kind of, his personal life is kind of at the core of why so many people thought there might have been, something other than a pure accident at work here.
And would it have been very clear to these men that the idea that, okay, well, you want to pull this out, you only want to pull this out a tiny bit, because if you yank it all the way out, the reactor is going to go supercritical in the blink of an eye, and then at that point, there's no turning back. I mean, would they have known perfectly well what would happen if they did this?
Well, they certainly should have known that. And one of the most striking things to me in doing this research was that, you know, everybody ever since has kind of presumed that, well, whoever did this must have known exactly what they were doing. But in the investigation immediately after the incident, where almost all the other operators were interviewed, there was a very astute government investigator named Leo Miazga. And he asked them all, were you surprised by what happened? And all the operators said they were. They knew that they weren't supposed to lift the rod more than 4 inches. That was clear in the procedure. But all of them were shocked by the level of destruction that occurred as a result of violating that procedure. They all thought, well, maybe there would be high radiation, or maybe, you know, something would melt. But all of them, to a man, were just stunned that there was actually an explosion. So they certainly should have known that, but it doesn't seem like they did. did know that.
So in addition, perhaps to being a real serious problem with design of the reactor, that perhaps in the kind of training that the men received, maybe we had a real problem there because somehow the idea wasn't gotten across to them seriously how bad it would be if something like that happened.
Well, I was so struck by the procedure and how kind of sketchy the procedure was that I reproduced the whole procedure in the book, which it only takes about a page. And the procedure says it's the procedure for disassembling a control rod drive mechanism, and then for reassembling it, it just says do the reverse. So it's a very, very sketchy procedure, and as a Navy guy that was kind of accustomed to massive procedures, it was, you know, it struck me very much, which is why I went ahead and reproduced the whole thing.
Yeah. Just very quickly here at this point, we're at our midpoint. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Todd Tucker. He's the author of the book Atomic America, How a Deadly Explosion and a Feared Admiral Changed the Course of Nuclear History. It's published by the Free Press. He himself served as an officer with the U.S. Navy's Nuclear Submarine Force, and also was the author of another book, and we talked about it here on the program, the book Notre Dame Versus the Klan was published in 2004. He's a graduate of University of Notre Dame. And if you'd like to read the book, it's out in the bookstores. And if you have questions, you can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps also we should explain that we talk in terms about the reactor exploding, which it did, but maybe we should explain we're not talking – it didn't explode like a nuclear bomb would explode. It exploded for a different reason.
Yeah, what happened was when the central control rod was yanked out for whatever reason, the reactor went supercritical. So the amount of fissions inside the core of uranium expanded kind of exponentially, generating an enormous amount of heat, which did two things. It kind of almost instantly not only melted all the fuel, but actually vaporized it. The temperature went up so high. And then this, in turn, caused the instantaneous flashing of all the water in the core to steam. So the reactor exploded, and this was a massive, you know, steel vessel, and the thing actually lifted 20 feet in the air. And like I said, all the shield plugs were ejected at enough velocity to pin that guy above the ceiling, 14 mm-hmm. feet above. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it was a steam explosion, but it would be wrong to characterize this as anything other than, you know, a nuclear accident. It certainly was a nuclear accident. And one of the big parts of the investigation after this was to determine whether the reactor had gone critical. And they did a series of very interesting analyses, and they determined just conclusively that the reactor had gone critical.
So there also apparently were some issues with the way that the rod fitted into the reactor that perhaps over time through wear and tear maybe made it difficult to get the rod to move.
Right.
And could it – I guess the idea might also have been that either, who knows, it was stuck or perhaps that the guy thought, oh, I could pull it out, but then if I put it back in real quick – we would have time enough to slow down the reaction. In any case, it sounds like there were some mechanical issues that contributed to the problem.
Well, right. SL-1 had been plagued. It was just notorious for having stuck rod problems. And, you know, as you mentioned, the control rod is kind of the fundamental safety mechanism of any reactor. When the rod is at the bottom of the core should be shut down. And so anything that imposes on the free movement of these control rods is really a big problem. And almost from the beginning of its life, SL-1 had been plagued by these problems with the control rods that were stuck in the channels. They wouldn't go all the way down. They couldn't move. So it's many people, including myself, believe that this was, you know, had something to do with the accident.
And did those problems, were they reported up the chain? Did the Army realize that there were problems, and did anybody think about the fact that could develop into a very serious problem?
The problems were enormous, very well documented. I've got all the statistics in the book about, you know, which control rod stuck and how many times. But the Army's reaction to the problems was they just, whatever procedures resulted in the rods being stuck, they just stopped doing those procedures rather than really addressing the root cause of what was causing the rods to be stuck. And what's so dangerous about that thinking is that a lot of people think that one of the things that was causing the rods to be stuck was there was this burnable poison called boron in the core that was embedded in the core, and these boron strips were flaking off, and a lot of people thought that's what was mechanically getting away the control rods. Well, not only would that stop the motion of the control rods, but it was also making the reactor that much more critical because this poison was flaking off and sinking to the bottom of the core.
Hmm.
So, you know, one of the big conclusions that I quote is that the Atomic Energy Commission said that a quote-unquote prudent operator would have not continued operating the core, which I think is certainly true.
Hmm. So how, in trying to take, you know, deconstruct this accident, try to figure out what happened and why, how did the Army approach that question?
Well, there were a number of kind of people independently investigating what happened, the Atomic Energy Commission, the Army, even the Navy was kind of running its own rogue investigation to see if they could learn anything from the accident. But they did a number of things. I mean, the investigation was pretty exhaustive. They created a whole mock-up of the reactor. They used conventional explosives to try and determine, like, how much power it took to cause that much destruction. So the investigation went on for well over a year while they tried to determine exactly what had happened.
Well, and what is, at the time, what was the official conclusion that they came to?
The official conclusion, like I said, and this is pretty much beyond dispute, was that the central control rod was withdrawn too far and too fast during the course of this maintenance. The official investigations left it, most of the investigations kind of left it up in the air about what the operator's motivation might have been in lifting the rod. They left it kind of open. The Atomic Energy Commission did not. In the cover letter to their investigation, they said that they specifically absolved the military cadre of any responsibility for the accident. But the other investigations, particularly the one by Combustion Engineering, really left it open for interpretation, and that it contributed to this folktale that grew up later on that Jack Burns had done this intentionally.
So no one came along and essentially said that because of problems with the design here and perhaps also with the level of training the operators received, no one came along and said this was an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah, well, like I said, the Atomic Energy Commission said almost those exact words, but I think the myth of this murder-suicide was just kind of too seductive, and they couldn't overwhelm that. And in fact, like I alluded to earlier, Jack Burns did have kind of some massive personal problems.
Yeah.
And so that those things together, it's just people will believe what they want to believe. And people in the nuclear power community didn't want to believe that a reactor would blow up due to poor design. They wanted to believe that, it was more comforting to believe that this was the result of a madman.
Well, and certainly there's a very important area of research into human factors in accidents, how people how it is they contribute to accidents happening. And here, at least, you end up thinking about the relationship between these three men, well, the two men in particular, the one man who was having a lot of problems in his personal life, and the other guy who was sort of a notorious kind of troublesome guy, the guy who was the supervisor. You have to wonder whether their relationship, the way they related to each other, perhaps the way they communicated when they were doing the job, how the supervisor behaved and how the other guy behaved, how that personal dynamic could have, you wouldn't say that it caused the accident, but you might say that it contributed. Yeah, it didn't help.
Didn't
help.
And that's correct. Jack Burns and Richard Legg were the two senior men in the cadre, and by senior, they weren't all that senior. They were relatively junior enlisted men. The third man, Richard McKinley, was essentially brand new. But Legg and Burns had confrontations in the past, and had actually been in a fist fight at a bachelor party about a year before the incident. So they definitely, But I think that that's probably not that unusual in a military setting to have young people with a young person's temper put in a high pressure situation. That's kind of what it's like in the real world and in the military. What was lacking at SL1 was a level of supervision to kind of balance that.
And I suppose it has something to do with, or maybe that's the reason why, in the military you got rule books And it says, all right, this is the rule. This is the way we do it. Step one, step two, step three. And everybody tends, you know, at least they're supposed to say, okay, we go by the book. And maybe so there's a good reason for going by the book when you're doing things.
Right. And, you know, and that only works if the book is right. And,
well, yeah.
And SL1, you know, like I said, the procedure was so sketchy that those three men could have really benefited from some experienced supervision, and they just didn't have it.
Yeah. You did talk earlier about the fact that the Army had this program, and what they were trying to do was develop reactors, small reactors, that would supply energy to small bases in remote locations. And, in fact, they had this base. It was in Greenland,
mm-hmm.
that where they actually had a place that they constructed, and for a period of a year, they powered it with a nuclear reactor. So it wasn't that they had no success.
No, the Army had some really notable successes. I identify Camp Century, that's that under ice base in Greenland, as the most notable. But they had some other ones. They had several reactors operate reliably for years, and one operate reliably for 10 years. So the Army had some real, like I said, some real notable successes, and Camp Century was definitely an amazing kind of feat, and I think one of the most remarkable achievements in the history of nuclear power.
And yet, then, though, what happened to the overall? What happened to the program after the accident at SL1?
It just got to the point where the powers that be determined, I think correctly, that the Army really shouldn't be in the business of operating nuclear power plants. That even though there were some strategic advantages, especially in these remote Arctic bases, it just wasn't worth the effort and the expense. And especially as Vietnam got underway, the Army just had other priorities that took over.
Well, then, and that gets us maybe back to this larger context. So we had this accident, and because of this accident, maybe some other reasons, the Army essentially moved away from this. The Air Force had been pouring money into its nuclear plane project for a long time without much result. And as you explained, finally, President Kennedy came along and said, look, we're just going to quit this. So then that really leaves, within the military, that leaves nuclear power to the Navy.
Right. And the United States Navy has for many years been the largest operator in the world of nuclear reactors, and that that all started in the late 50s with the submarine program.
And I suppose, among other things, that was the thing that really saved the Navy.
Yeah, I think there's definitely my comrades in arms who fly carrier aircraft and other things would argue with me that saved the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely, I don't think there's any arguing that Rickover and what he accomplished with nuclear ships, fundamentally changed the Navy. And I don't think there's any arguing that.
Yeah. Was there something other than this affecting the balance of power and influence of the services, and perhaps also at least contributing to bringing the Navy back from this point, say, after World War II and into the Cold War, when some people were saying, well, do we really need a big Navy, or what kind of Navy do we need? Was there some way that this story had a larger, did it have anything to do with the power among the branches, or with who had influence, or even with how people thought about developing new and novel kinds of systems?
Well, I think that with the advent of the nuclear Navy, the Navy became central to the United States strategic military plans. Nuclear submarines and missile-carrying nuclear submarines really became, a central part of America's strategic plans. That's something I don't think would have happened without the advent of nuclear power. I think that the Army it determined that it didn't need to be in the power generation business, and the Air Force never was able to develop its nuclear airplane. So,
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Someone here where we are, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. The first thing I have to confess, I forgot to tune in. I wanted to hear this one, but I guess I'll have to hear it on the archive. The premise that the only fatalities were at this reactor are still being tested. It seems to me that it's hard to believe, but Three Mile Island still has a lawsuit that's extant that accuses the iodine releases over a long period of time, causing excess deaths or whatever you want to call it. So I don't think I don't accept the premise. It's still being argued, as I guess we should say. On the military and nuclear power and nuclear uses of nuclear period, I don't know if have you investigated General Grove, the head of the Manhattan Project? And I that might be a digression. I don't know whether you have a comment on the first part.
Well, I think, you know, my story really begins as the Manhattan Project ends. Many of the people in all branches of the military that were involved in nuclear power programs had come out of the Manhattan Project. Almost all of them had. But, I, you know, that wasn't really – my story is really about nuclear power and not so much about nuclear bombs.
Uh-huh. Are you confident you know how many of them there actually were? How many of these smaller reactors that they were experimenting with?
I don't know.
Has the Navy ever really admitted that the Thresher was a nuclear accident?
No. There's been two nuclear submarines lost in history, and, you know, the circumstances are a little bit cloudy on both, less so on the Thresher. The Thresher is pretty well documented because it was on sea trials. The Scorpion was the submarine that kind of lost without a trace. But you're asking how many reactors. At Idaho, at the National Reactor Testing Station at the time of the accident, there were over 40 reactors being run not just by the military, but by the civilians and Argonne Laboratory, et cetera. The Army in its history ran 8 nuclear reactors in all, including SL-1.
Were there any at Rocky Flats? Because that's a notorious...
No, Rocky Flats was a
processing
facility,
plant.
Yeah. But the Air Force ran some nuclear reactors as well, although they never came close to putting one inside an airframe.
Yeah, well, the nuclear coup was an idea that somebody had at some point too, but there are a lot of mad fancies. Thanks a lot.
All right. Just to go back to the case of these two, the United States has only lost two nuclear submarines, the Thresher and the Scorpion. Not long ago, I talked with somebody who had written a book about the Scorpion who makes the claim that it was actually attacked by the Russians, and I don't know how one, you know. I thought it was interesting. I'm not sure I felt like I was in a position one way or another to evaluate that, and I guess there's a lot of debate about whether that argument is right or not.
I think it's correct to say that the disappearance of the Scorpion is a mystery, and I don't think anybody can say definitively what happened. But the Scorpion just disappeared, so nobody really knows what happened. Unlike the Thresher, where they actually have audio tapes of this thing sinking to the bottom of the ocean.
And now this didn't have, or did it? The Thresher didn't have anything to do with this nuclear reactor, did it?
No, most people don't think so. Most people think it was a flooding casualty, and then the emergency ballast tank system failed to work properly during the flooding. But you know, there are those that will argue that it was it had something to do with the reactor, but nobody really knows.
Mm. Going back to the other question the caller raised, we did talk earlier about the fact that the SL-1 explosion did release nuclear material. A lot of it apparently did manage to stay within the building, but it did release some nuclear material. Are there people who have argued that it has resulted in health effects for people who lived in the area around there in Idaho?
Well, there are definitely people that have anecdotal evidence that there were long-term problems, and then on the other hand, there are firefighters that were the second on the scene that are alive and well, and were happy to talk to me about it. So there's been no like long-term epidemiology of the area, but you can see the studies at the time. There is data about how much radiation got into the milk of local dairy farms and stuff. It was there was definitely a massive environmental release that went way beyond the boundaries of the reactor testing station.
Mm. I suppose just as you mentioned, given the fact that one of the things that made the whole business of trying to deal with the accident so difficult for the for people who were technicians and rescue people and trying to figure out what was going on, and was indeed the fact that there was so much radioactivity in the building that, as you said, that they could only be in there for a minute at a time. I'm not exactly sure how you do much of anything in 30 seconds to a minute. It's sort of remarkable that, in fact, apparently none of those people seem to suffer any real serious ill effect.
Well, I would hesitate to say that none of them did. I just think there's no long-term study of those people that did it to really tell us one way or another. There are definitely anecdotes about people that were on the scene early that did, you know, seem to die early, but there's no kind of rigorous studies to tell us that that's a result of SL1.
So what did they do? How did they have to deal with the remains of these three men?
That was one of the early controversies, and it's really one of the more controversial parts of the whole episode was how those bodies were treated. The people in charge, there was a debate as to whether these bodies could ever be returned to the families for kind of a proper burial, and because they were so just incredibly radioactive and dangerous, and people actually debated just interning these men as radioactive waste. And in the end, it was just determined that was just too inhumane to not return something to the families. So they did an autopsy where they reduced the radioactivity as much as they could and then sealed the bodies in these specially made lead-lined caskets and returned them to their families. But to reduce the radiation, in most of the cases, they had to hack off significant parts of the corpses that were buried as radioactive waste just to get these bodies to the point where they could be transported safely and buried even in the lead-lined caskets. And one of them, Jack Burns, is buried in upstate New York. Richard Legg is buried in Kingston, Michigan. And McKinley is buried in Arlington.
Hmm. And have there not been any problems related to their remains in the year since?
No, Kingston, Michigan is a small town, and it was a big event when this happened, when this local boy was brought back in his lead-lined casket and buried in a 60-second funeral. So there's been, you know, the kind of predictable local folklore about the effects, and every now and then the presence of that casket contributes to a local controversy about land development and things like that. But as far as I can tell, no long-term consequences. But it's not exaggerating to say that those bodies were just lethally radioactive.
Yeah. How, if one looked at these men's service records, how was this, their conduct in this matter, any judgment about what happened? Was that reflected there, and was there any, was it just left to say, well, we really don't know, or was there some suggestion that it might have been, you know, that they might have bore some of the responsibility as a result of error or anything else like that?
Like I said, in the official report, in the Atomic Energy Commission report, the three men were specifically absolved in those words of any responsibility. It's just been kind of in the mythology that's grown up about SL1 where they've taken the brunt of the blame.
So now, over the, you know, we talked about the fact that certainly this event contributed to the Army's essentially shutting down the program, that the Air Force had a program. It was shut down because it was regarded to be a waste of money, and that though then among the services, it was the Navy that ended up being the one that developed and used nuclear power. And in fact, I think you said it was the Navy's the biggest operator of nuclear reactors, and U.S. Navy biggest operator of nuclear reactors in the world. Did any of this have an impact, go on and have an impact on the civilian nuclear industry, the use of nuclear power to generate electricity?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the biggest effect is that the United States Navy is by far the largest training ground there is for nuclear operators in the civilian world. So that's one effect. The nuclear plants of America, and there are 104 at the moment, you know, there's very few places they have to draw on experienced people other than the United States Navy. So much of the Navy's philosophy has become the civilian industry's philosophy, which is to the benefit of us all, I believe. The other kind of major macro change that happened is, I think, with SL1, there died this dream of the kind of the small portable reactor, a nuclear reactor in every garage, which had been kind of a fantasy of the atomic age from the very beginning, where I quoted some of the more incredible statements at the beginning, where people thought that we would have, you know, brick-sized nuclear reactors that would power our cars forever without ever needing to refuel. And SL1 was you know, one of the things that contributed to the end of that dream.
Yeah. Just to go back a step in what can you talk a little bit more about? You said something like the philosophy or the approach to this technology in the Navy has carried over to the civilian nuclear power industry. In what way do you mean that?
Well, I think Rickover really believes that nuclear power was an extraordinary thing, and he had to create kind of a whole new way of doing business within the Navy to handle it. And that, you know, that it's difficult to summarize, but it basically was this attitude of kind of relentless self assessment and a relentless assessment of responsibility and root causes. And you know, Rickover lived his own life that way, and he definitely demanded that of his people.
So that in terms of training procedures, following procedures, all of that much more rigorous in the Navy than anywhere else, at least elsewhere in the military?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, in the book I try and show, you know, I try and contrast how the Navy did things compared to the other services. When, you know, when the Army had stuck rods in SL1, they said, okay, well, we're just going to stop doing those procedures that show that the rods are stuck. Whereas in the Navy, you know, if there was an accident like that, Rickover would have promptly required several heads on a platter. And you know, the legend of Rickover is replete with those kinds of stories.
Well, this is a remarkable example about how much influence one strong-willed individual can have.
It is,
and certainly in his case, that's maybe calling him strong-willed is a great understatement.
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of maniacally strong-willed, but you know, in reading this story and looking at other people's attempts at doing what Rickover did, I just came to the conclusion that that's what it took. That if this was ever going to happen, that you know, the United States is fortunate that it had a guy like Hyman Rickover at the time it did, because I honestly don't think anybody else could have pulled it off.
Huh. Well, we're just about at the time that we have to finish. I think we've done a fairly good job talking about the story, and of course, if people want to read it in greater depth, they can look at the book. What's your takeaway from this story, do you think?
The takeaway?
Yeah.
I think, there's several takeaways. I mean, I think that, I think that despite the accident of SL1, the Army had some interesting and notable successes, and I think that the story of the Air Force's program shows that, you know, you have to be able to look at these kind of programs with clear eyes and see who's actually making progress and who's not. And I think the other one is something you just said, that sometimes to achieve, you know, remarkable things, you have to have, you know, a guy like Rickover around to make it happen. Mm.
The book is Atomic America, How a Deadly Explosion and a Feared Admiral Changed the Course of Nuclear History. It's published by the Free Press by our guest Todd Tucker. He served as an officer with the U.S. Navy's Nuclear Submarine Force. He's the author of two other books, Notre Dame Game Day and Notre Dame versus the Klan, and also The Great Starvation Experiment, and you can look for those books. He lives in Valparaiso, Indiana. Mr. Tucker, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. It was great to be back.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
It's coming up on 11:59, and the Afternoon Magazine begins now here on WILL, AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2. And HD3 Urbana with a look at the markets and Turning to Kansas City wheat, we see July at 646 and a half, up 3 3/4 right now. September at 657, up 4 1/4. December at 671 3/4, up 5. July wheat in Chicago at 593 1/2, up 4 1/2. September at 618, up 3 1/2. December at 642 1/4, up 5. July corn at 424 1/4 is down 1 1/2. September at 433 3/4, down 1 1/2. December at 445 3/4, down 1 1/4. March 2010 at 455 3/4, down 1. And May at 462 1/2, down 1. The July crude oil contract at 61.49 is up 1.37. July soybeans 11.65, up 3. August 11.30 1/2, up 10 1/2. September at 10.63 3/4, up 12 3/4. November at 10.14, up 18. January 2010 at 10.15, up 17 1/2. And March at 10.09, up 16. July soybean meal 3.74 even, unchanged. And August at 3.57.90, up 2.20. The soybean oil for July at 38.33, up 16. August at 38.49, up 16.